basically a market in Alaska, sort of its own little fuel commodity market. The price is determined by the last barrel into the market.
Explaining Alaska's high gasoline prices. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 21st of November. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, a company that owns several newspapers in the state hits hard times.
We are looking at every single publication, and if those publications aren't profitable, then we are going to shut them down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A government witness who testified against Senator Ted Stevens last month says he lied under oath and that prosecutors gave false evidence at the trial. But prosecutors are fighting back and say the witness is lying now. Senator Stevens was convicted last month of filing false financial statements. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
David Anderson worked for oilfield services company Vico as a welder. He testified in a federal courtroom last month that Vico paid him to work on Senator Stevens' Girdwood home. He wasn't the only one. Numerous men said Vico paid them to work on the renovation project. But Anderson was the government's final witness and testified that he was a type of supervisor. He explained the project in detail and said he spent months working at the house. However, Anderson now says he lied in some of that testimony. He makes that claim in a letter to the court that was placed on the record today. Anderson says he lied about having an immunity deal. During the trial, he testified that the government did not offer him immunity. But now Anderson says he had a handshake deal with the FBI that he and his family would be protected from prosecution if he testified against Stevens. Prosecutors say that's false. This isn't the first time Anderson has flip-flopped on his story. On the witness stand last month, he said he lied in an earlier written statement about the immunity question. Anderson says that lie was because the Justice Department told him to sugarcoat their deal and sweep it under the rug. In the earlier written statement, Anderson claimed he was promised immunity for himself and a number of relatives and friends, including former state senator Jerry Ward. Anderson lives with Ward's daughter. Ward is facing legal troubles of his own. He's been implicated in another corruption case. The government did not sign that letter and says it's false. In a bizarre twist, David Anderson says he wanted to have the written statement as a record because he feared being murdered. He says former Vico CEO Bill Allen and his son Mark had a contract to have him killed. Bill Allen is his uncle. Also in his recent letter, Anderson says the government groomed him for the trial and refreshed his memory about the construction project. He says that influenced his testimony. The government says that's not true and that they have additional evidence, including video surveillance and documents that prove Anderson is lying now and that show Anderson colluded with a, quote, interested party in the preparation of his letter. The government says they'll submit more information about that to the court on Monday. Senator Stevens' lawyers are requesting a hearing about Anderson's letter. They also plan to appeal the case. Stevens says he's innocent, and yesterday, in his last address on the Senate floor, said that he looks forward to lifting the cloud that surrounds him. The court has not yet responded to Stevens' lawyers' request for a hearing. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Bar associations in Alaska, California, and Washington, D.C. are seeking to suspend the law license of Senator Ted Stevens. Spokesmen for all three bar associations say they have filed or will file to suspend Stevens' licenses. Stevens' lawyers have until Monday to file a response with the Alaska Supreme Court. Stevens is on the inactive roster in all three places. He has given no indication he wants to resume a law career. Steve Van Gore with the Alaska Bar Association says there's nothing unusual about the request to suspend Stevens' license to practice law.
Historically, lawyers who have been convicted of felonies or serious crimes have received, by and large, lengthy suspensions or have been disbarred from the practice of law in Alaska.
No sentencing date has been set for Ted Stevens. The 85-year-old senator is appealing his criminal conviction. The House Judiciary Committee is ready to begin preparing a report on the disparity between Alaska fuel prices and what it's being sold for in the lower 48. However, no change in the system is expected anytime soon. In a lengthy hearing this morning, members listened to explanations that could help the public understand why gasoline is about a dollar higher than it is in Seattle and California markets. Kip Knudsen, manager of Tesoro's refinery on the Kenai Peninsula, says it's the same gasoline.
Gasoline, even in Alaska, is a commodity.
He says the economic basis of a commodity's price is determined by supply and demand within a market. And one of the economic traits of a commodity is that it doesn't care about the producer.
Everybody continues to say, well, it costs you more to make gas. The commodity market really doesn't care how much it costs us to make the product, because it's all come back down to supply and demand. In the long run, however, if a commodity price falls below a producer's cost, eventually a producer or multiple producers will go out of business. Supply will tighten, prices will go back up. The basic supply and demand.
Knudsen says one of the peculiar aspects of the fuel markets is that the price the market is willing to pay is based on the last barrel into the mix, wherever it comes from.
Basically, a market in Alaska is sort of its own little fuel commodity market. The price is determined by the last barrel into the market. The last barrel is an import. The price of that import sets the price. If the last barrel in the market comes out of a refinery, that sets the price of the market.
Imported fuel that's shipped into the state from the lower 48 is typically more expensive, but normally only by a few cents. Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen told the committee that an example of this principle is the tank farm in Juneau, where some 10 to 15 million barrels of fuel are stored. He says the market determines its price when the tanks are topped off, which doesn't happen all that often.
Timing has a big influence on what those delivered in-tank prices are. And it may take Juneau 2 or 3 months to exhaust that supply before it's time to bring more fuel in and replenish. So that the dynamics of fuel pricing in an import market like Juneau, I think Mr. Knudsen mentioned, is a lot different than it is in Anchorage, where we do have refineries.
Sniffen is investigating fuel price discrepancies and looking for evidence of price fixing among suppliers. His report is expected by the end of the year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kodiak scientist looks at the problem of ocean acidification.
If the food chain in the ocean is altered dramatically because of this acidification, it could have global impacts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from the Alaska Sea Life Center, Alaska's unique marine research facility and public aquarium.
The owner of the Juneau Empire, the Homer News, and the Peninsula Clarion is in financial trouble. The papers are all owned by Morris Publishing Group in Georgia. Wall Street analysts last week lowered Morris Publishing's credit rating, and one analyst told KTOO's John Ryan yesterday there's a greater than 50% chance Morris will have to default on its debts.
In a conference call last week with investment analysts, Morris reported a third quarter loss of $163 million. Like most newspapers, Morris Publications rely on advertising for most of their income. Company officials said advertising revenues were down throughout the Morris chain. CEO Will Morris said the company had been pursuing various measures to regain financial health.
We are constantly analyzing our overall cost structure. We have reduced staff, made changes in our benefits programs, and implemented various initiatives to save costs and improve our operating efficiencies.
Since January 2007, Morris has eliminated about 600 jobs, or nearly one-fifth of its workforce. The company also sold off 14 daily newspapers last year. Morris Publishing has more than $400 million in debts, which it is obliged to pay off by next summer. Vice President for Newspapers Jim Carreau said everything is on the table in the company's continued efforts to reduce its debt load.
We are looking at every single publication, and if those publications aren't profitable, then we are going to shut them down. But in most cases, these are smaller publications.
The Juno Empire is one of Morris's smaller publications. It has 52 employees and a daily circulation of 6,500. Empire publisher Bob Hale said the Juno paper is indeed profitable, but he would not provide details. Hale said he was under orders to refer all media calls to the Georgia headquarters. Morris Publishing Chief Financial Officer Steve Stone declined to comment. The company's publicly announced strategies for improving its bottom line have not convinced Wall Street analysts. Standard & Poor's last week lowered Morris Publishing's credit ratings because of sagging revenue and severe debt load. S&P credit analyst Emil Courtney says Morris's new CCC credit rating means there's a better than even chance the company will go bankrupt. He says one potential outcome of bankruptcy is a restructuring of the company.
Morris Publishing could be restructured as what we call a going concern, meaning they pretty much stay in business as they are. Another outcome of bankruptcy could potentially be an asset liquidation, which is where a company essentially tries to sell assets in order to get cash.
The newspaper industry as a whole is in turmoil. Circulations are sagging and advertisers jumping ship to internet locations like Google and Craigslist. Newspapers nationwide have shed thousands of jobs this year. Editor and Publisher magazine reports the McClatchy chain has cut a quarter of its workforce this year. McClatchy owns Alaska's largest paper, the Anchorage Daily News. The industry's prospects for 2009 aren't much better. The Associated Press plans to cut 400 employees this year, or about 10% of its global workforce. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Morris Publishing is a subsidiary of Morris Communications. In Alaska, Morris Communications puts out Alaska Magazine, the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and the Mile Post. It also owns six radio stations in the Anchorage market. About a third of the large cruise ships sailing along Alaska's coast this year violated government wastewater discharge standards, but most had only occasional problems meeting state permitting requirements. The bigger problem will come in a few years when stricter standards kick in. An industry spokesman says that could drive ships to discharge outside state waters. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details.
About 30 large cruise ships sailed to Alaska during the summer tourist season. 20 discharged wastewater under the state permit system, and regulators say 12 exceeded safety limits for a total of 45 violations. The most frequent problem was with ammonia from sewage, but some ships also violated limits on copper and zinc. Denise Koch manages the state's cruise ship wastewater program.
We're, of course, a little disappointed about that, but in some senses, not completely surprised. From reviewing past data when we before we issued this permit, we had some sense that cruise ships were going to have difficulty meeting some of the parameters in the permit.
The industry is more positive about the results. The Alaska Cruise Association compiled its own information, and President John Binkley says it shows a high level of compliance.
We were operating under a new permit system that just went into place in May of this year with much tighter limits. And out of the over 3,600 tests that were done on the ships, we had 47 that exceeded some of those new limits. So that's about a 98.7% compliance, and I'd call that A+ for the season.
He says the industry can do an even better job of meeting the standards, but they're a temporary measure with much more stringent limits kicking in two seasons from now. Binkley says the cruise lines may not be able to meet the new standards. Then the ships would stop discharging in Alaska altogether, avoiding the new regulations. That's what about 10 ships have already chosen to do.
We'll have to steam out to federal waters to discharge what really are the cleanest water that is produced by any system in the state of Alaska. And that'll cost us more time and more fuel to be able to get out to federal waters to discharge. And it will probably require us to alter our itineraries and our port times in Southeast Alaska.
The limits come from a voter-approved ballot measure called the Cruise Ship Initiative. Clean water activist Gershon Cohen is one of its authors. He says dumping wastewater farther from shore goes against the will of the voters.
The standards are what they are because of good science. You know, the industry folks are always saying, well, we want to use good science when we come up with these rules. Well, the rules that we're asking to have enforced are, in fact, the rules that scientists, EPA scientists, have come up with years ago for what levels of pollutants are, in fact, harmful to aquatic life. And if you exceed those standards, then you're taking a chance of impacting the resource.
The past season's violations have brought no penalties so far. The state has issued notices listing fines up to $10,000 against an individual or $200,000 against a company. But the process is ongoing, and much smaller settlements are likely to result. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The state is targeting hundreds of wolves again this winter as part of its ongoing predator control programs. More than 700 animals could be taken to benefit moose and caribou populations in six areas of the state, from the Alaska Peninsula to the interior. The wolf control programs allow state-certified pilot gunner teams to track and shoot wolves from the air or after landing. Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms in Fairbanks says the wolf harvest objectives are based on rough population estimates developed for each control zone. Harms says the information comes from biologists conducting aerial surveys and pilots participating in the control programs.
If we have two different people see a group of eight, four black and four gray wolves in one particular area, we can identify that as a pack. And we get to know what the population is based on the different sightings during the year.
Harm says biologists then figure out how many wolves can be taken in each area without endangering the population. The wolf kill has fallen below objectives in most control zones in recent years, but Bruce Bartley with Fish and Game's Anchorage office says that doesn't mean the programs are a failure.
What's important is that come spring when the program's over is how close we are to that minimum objective number. You know, the complaint has been that we haven't been meeting our objectives, but in fact, particularly in Unit 13, we've been very successful in meeting them. In at least 2 years, we've shut down the program early because we were down to that minimum number that we wanted left in the population.
The state's newest predator control zone targets wolves on the calving grounds of the southern Alaska Peninsula caribou herd, where the department hopes to eliminate as many wolves as it can. Statewide, more than 660 wolves have been taken in the predator control effort that began in 2003. Over 3,000 wolves are harvested annually in Alaska by hunters and trappers independent of the program.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks will travel a planetarium around rural Alaska. A nearly $500 million NASA grant to UAF's Geophysical Institute will pay for the 3-year tour that will hit dozens of communities. Project organizer and planetary scientist Robert Herrick says the specialized planetarium, purchased with funding from BP and ConocoPhillips last year, is designed for portability.
There's essentially three components to this system, a dome, which is kind of a tent-like structure. It's more of a something you blow up with a fan. The other component is a projection system, high-definition television projector with a fisheye lens attached. And then the system is driven by a personal computer that has amateur astronomy software on it.
Herrick says the entire package fits into a couple trunks that can be checked as airline baggage. It includes both a smaller classroom-sized dome and a larger dome for use in a gymnasium. The system projects a simulated star field on the ceiling of the dome. Herrick says it's also capable of projecting photos or videos.
So one of the things that we did over the summer was take some time-lapse aurora photography that was taken by some of the graduate students here and showed that in the dome. So it can show both true images of the night sky, or it can simulate the night sky not only from Earth but from anywhere else in the solar system, or really outside the solar system if you want to do it that way as well.
Herrick says the portable planetarium has been used to educate kids in the Fairbanks area and was taken to two North Slope communities earlier this year. The Geophysical Institute is teaming with the University of Alaska Museum on the Rural Outreach Project as a way to jumpstart kids' interest in science. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has commissioned a panel to study ocean acidification. From KMXT in Kodiak, Jay Barrett has more.
As the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increase, as they have since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the amount of gas diffusing into the world's oceans has increased as well. Estimates are that a third or more of the carbon dioxide created from burning coal and petroleum products on an industrial scale have been absorbed by the oceans and has actually moderated the effects of global warming. However, there is a downside, according to Bob Foy, a NOAA scientist in Kodiak.
The potential problem of ocean acidification is quite large. You know, until now, most of the studies related to climate change or human impacts on the climate have been related to temperature, and we found that the effects of temperature on Earth are quite overwhelming. The potential impacts of ocean acidification they could be greater. The base of the oceanic food chain is all made up of organisms that require calcium carbonate. So if the food chain in the ocean is altered dramatically because of this acidification, it could have global impacts.
Foy is a biologist with NOAA's Kodiak Fisheries Research Center. He won't be on the NOAA NSF panel, but research from his laboratory will be used by them.
Most of the carbon dioxide that's in the ocean is natural, and most of it is on the bottom of the ocean. But since the Industrial Revolution and the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, there has been an increased amount of CO2 going into solution in the surface waters of the ocean. And CO2 is corrosive. So what that means is when you have more CO2 in the water, the end result is more carbonic acid. So therefore, you have more lower pH or higher acidity. The acidity is not enough that you and I could feel it. It's actually extremely small, 0.2 of a pH unit, but that's very important for a biological system.
The base of the ocean's food chain includes microscopic crustaceans, which, by definition, have shells that need a certain level of calcium carbonate in the water to form. Fish, crab, and even some whales feed on them, and they in turn are fed on by others. If the base of the food supply is disrupted, it could cause massive disruption to sea life. In his Kodiak laboratory, Foy is studying the effects of acidic ocean water on red and blue king crabs and their ability to form their shells. He says the depth at which the carbon dioxide concentrations start to inhibit shell formation is fairly shallow in the North Pacific Ocean.
The ocean that upwells in the North Pacific is older water. It holds more carbon dioxide. Add in the impacts of the human impact since the Industrial Revolution, and that makes the waters in the North Pacific much more corrosive than anywhere else.
The 18-month study will be conducted by the National Academy of Sciences, which, along with the National Research Council, will put together a panel of 10 to 12 scientists with expertise in various oceanographic fields. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium hopes the coming change in the nation's administration will improve the funding picture for tribal health care. Search CEO Roald Helgason outlined the consortium's mission, successes, and challenges in a presentation to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce this week. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Helgason took over management of Search last fall following the unexpected death of former CEO Ken Brewer. A lifelong Sitkan, Helgason built his career in healthcare administration mostly outside of the region. The Alaska Journal of Commerce last year named him one of Alaska's top 40 under 40. In Helgason's presentation to the Sitka Chamber, he portrayed an organization that was thriving. Founded in the 1970s, Helgason called the consortium the grandchild of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. The organization now is comprised of 18 regional tribal governments with a total annual budget of about $90 million. Helgason said Search employed 511 full-time positions in Sitka alone, earning a payroll of about $31 million. About 50% of Search's budget comes from the Federal Indian Health Service. In response to a question from the audience, Helgason said that funding had been flat over the last several years in relation to inflation and that Search was doing more with less. He hoped the new administration would bring a new look at tribal health care funding.
Our hope is that will get increased view by both the congressional delegations and the new administration, and that we might see increased funding coming in the near future. If anybody's got the crystal ball and knows the fact, please let me know. But my best guess is probably see status quo for the rest of federal fiscal year 2009, and we'll see the first real budget for 2010. And that will tell us a lot. There's a lot of challenges. The economy, the war, that means there's less funding for Medicare, for Medicaid, for tribal health.
Audience questions brought out other substantive, candid responses from Search's new CEO. Helgeson was asked about the drift of jobs from Sitka to Juneau and the rapid expansion of the Juneau Clinic. Helgeson assured the room that growth in Juneau was not coming at the expense of Sitka's Mount Edgecombe Hospital.
Our hope is that the Juneau Clinic will get bigger and bigger, but we do run a hospital here in Sitka, and this is where our hospital location is. There's several million dollars tied up in that operation, and to replicate that anywhere would be extremely expensive. Probably, I would just guesstimate on the order of $300 million or more to replicate that. We have a physical plant here in Sitka. We utilize that physical plant. We don't have any immediate plans to make a change.
Helgeson said that demand in Search's Juneau outpatient clinic had grown 300% over the last several years, and that Search had to meet the need of Juneau's growing native population. An audience member asked him about the role of transportation in that change. Helgeson did not mince words.
Transportation does equal access to care. The current transportation links for surface transportation in Southeast Alaska, for the most part, routes patients through Juneau in order to get here to Sitka. That is cumbersome. That's a burden on our patients, especially in Northern Lynn Canal. We used to call it the village circuit service with the LeConte, where you knew it was coming, you knew when it was coming. You'd come in early in the week, it would leave later in the week. We knew that our patients could get care. They knew it wasn't going to be weather dependent on getting here. They felt comfortable about that. And that's been challenged by the changes in the transportation patterns, the routes that have taken. The way it is now, the majority of our patients have to be flown to receive services in Sitka.
Helgeson said that air travel for patients was expensive and weather dependent. He said, if you're looking for an answer from us about how important surface transportation is, it's essential. But Helgeson also stressed that Search did not know if the transportation picture would change. For its part, he said Search's new 32-bed extended stay facility in Sitka should help patients better manage their travel to town. Also, Helgeson said Search was overhauling its internal records system to make updated medical records available instantly in clinics throughout the region, since generally, people moved faster than paper. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. APRN would like to thank BP for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8439. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.